Who likes disaster movies? Yeah, a couple of hands straight up. Can anybody name a disaster movie? I'm going to go first and say Titanic. Oh, everyone else was going, all right. Any other disaster movies? Yes, Poseidon Adventure. Snakes on the plane. Yes, I thought. Oh yes, great. A lot of disaster movies. There's another type of disaster too, and I think it's like the ones Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, which is so bad it has a cult following now of people who watch it because it's one of the worst movies ever. Or Alexander is another example. Or pretty much anything with Adam Sandler in it, come to think of it. I remember a movie from the 80s called The Money Pit. Oh, yeah, a few people there. Had Tom Hanks and Shelley Long, in which a couple buy a mansion cheap, which looks too good to be true. And it is. The house begins to fall apart and ends up costing much, much more than they can afford. That's another type of disaster. Now, I had an interesting dig into the book of Job. It could be classified as a disaster, especially for Job. It turns out, as I explained earlier, that there's a lot of evidence that Job did exist, but there's a lot of argument about how much. And some people say 100% it's made up, others say 100% true. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle, but that's only my opinion. But I did find there's an awful lot to read about Job. And it's it really is a more interesting book than I thought. It is a little long-winded, so it's a bit hard to stick with. Could Job be classified as a disaster movie? It has all the hallmarks. First, there's a dialogue between Satan and God, in which Satan challenges God to ruin Job, because God was always saying how wonderful Job was. What a wonderful servant. I mean, he was always looking after his kids and sacrificing on their behalf, and the fact that he was extremely rich was beside the point. But God said to Satan, all right, if you think that Job wouldn't follow me anymore if I ruin him, I'll give you permission, thank you. I'll give you permission to test him. So in phase one, in one single day, Job lost his livestock. We're talking thousands of sheep, cattle, donkeys, oxen, all of them gone. And no sooner had he been told that he'd lost all his livestock, that someone came in and said all his servants had been killed as well. And above that, his children, who were celebrating a feast together, got hit by lightning, all dead. That's a pretty bad day. He still refused to blame God. Satan went a little further. And in phase two, he was given permission to give him a terrible illness of sores all over his body. He was covered with them. And in the end, he was found sitting in a pile of ashes, scraping his sores with a piece of broken pottery. All right, now there's a picture of misery if you've ever seen one. But just to top that, his wife, who was very helpful, said, curse God and die. He still refused to blame God. And then phase three, possibly the worst one, his friends come to comfort him. And all they do in their long dialogues is basically try to convince him that he must somehow deserve this punishment from God. Because there must be a reason for your punishment. You've done something wrong, or your ancestors have, or something. And that goes on for quite some time. They all get a lot to say. In the end, God himself tells them to shut up. Job eventually accuses God of being unfair, but quickly retracts it when God, speaking from a whirlwind, sets him straight. And I chose the RSV version because it really tells out Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? It's a sort of questioning I'd like to see applied to some of the opinionated people who dominate the media these days. The book's theme is around the eternal problem of undeserved suffering. Why did this awful thing happen to me or to us? Job and his friends were completely wrong about God. God is not in the business of rewarding and punishing human beings. God's revelation to Job and to us is that the universe is far bigger, far stranger, and much more mysterious than we can imagine. The book of Job gives an account of a righteous man who faithfully responded to difficult trials. And his experience invites us to ponder difficult questions about the causes of suffering, the frailty of human existence, and the reasons to trust in God, even when life seems unfair. One author I read a fair bit of was a gentleman named Daniel J. Simonson. In the end, he asserts that a relationship of trust with God is more important than our questions of why. Even if he knew the answers to his questions, Job would probably not be satisfied with an intellectual solution. Job's deeper need was to know that God had not abandoned him, that he still cared for him. And what most sufferers need, Simonson writes, is a visit from God. So, in our gospel reading, Jesus wanted to leave quickly and make a risky overnight crossing. They left immediately, and it says in verse 36, just as he was. No preparation, no going to grab your hat or your coat or raincoat. He was completely undeterred in his mission. Nothing would stop him, not even a storm. And the objective was to get away as quickly as possible, partly because he had so much to do and partly because he was so tired. The fatigue and longing for quiet. It's still pretty early in Jesus' ministry, and his followers don't know him all that well. What better way to bond than a near-death experience? The Sea of Galilee is known for sudden and severe storms, and that's exactly what happened while they were trying to make a quick crossing. Mark doesn't say how severe the storm was, but there were four experienced fishermen in the group and they thought they were going to die. They woke Jesus up, and maybe we hear just a touch of petulance in their appeal. Maybe they were a little miffed that Jesus was sleeping while they were bailing water and pulling hard on the oars. Mark indicates the frustration and fear in the disciples when they rouse Jesus, asking him if he cares that they're about to drown. Then, Jesus acted to calm the storm. Calmed the storm, then he added a little rebuke about their faith. What do we take from this? What lesson is there for us in the face of Jesus acting to control nature itself? And what does it tell us? There are some who believe that Jesus is able to control and calm our every storm. That if we just had enough faith, the road may be smoothed out by him for us. I think it might be true that if we faithfully live by Christ's instruction, we may have less overall problems. On the other hand, maybe if we're fighting hard for Jesus' causes, we might actually have more problems. We could be making our own. But the truth is, scriptures don't promise that Jesus will calm every storm or every personal problem. The central truth of the passage is that Jesus is God. He has power over the wind and the waves, and he is in fact God in flesh. By extension, because Jesus is God, we can trust him and choose to live in faith in him rather than fear. Storms or personal crises, accidents, are not caused or allowed by God. They just happen. They can be a growing and learning experience for all of us, no matter how painful, as we continue to be refined by the Holy Spirit. And after a tough day, how many of us sit down and say, "I really grew today"? Or, on the other hand, do we say, "I'm defeated"? I think probably we usually say the latter. But the truth is that the Spirit works in us through all the hard times, through all the tears, the frustrations, and even the illnesses. The application to our lives is that even when Jesus leads us through the valley of the shadow of death, we should fear no evil, for he is with us. We too can rest in faith during the storm. Our boat is not going down because Jesus is on board. He's also our anchor. He hasn't promised to calm every storm, but he has promised that he will never leave us and never forsake those who trust.